This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, December 16th, 2011. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. KUAF is supported by Ben Owen Shelter Insurance Agency, providing auto, home, and life insurance. 582-4990 for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we'll take you on a tour of businesses with locally produced liquor. Plus, we have a preview of the Claudia Burson Quartet's concerts scheduled for this evening in Fayetteville. And a Springdale church prepares for the grand opening of Christopher's House, which will provide a place to live for families in need of transitional housing.
We first reported on Common Core last summer, a new kindergarten through 12th grade college and career ready curriculum. Previously, each state set its own educational standards, but the Common Core State Standards Initiative is providing a shared national framework to boost achievement as well as to meet global education standards. Last summer, we reported that 44 states had signed on. Now, all but one have adopted it, including Arkansas. Ozark at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on how one local school district is launching Common Core, and the University of Arkansas has retooled its education curriculum incorporating it.
Willis Shaw Elementary is located 7 miles northwest of Springdale, way out in the country, and serves 540 students. 10% are English language learners. 40% qualify for free and reduced lunch. They live in the surrounding communities of Elm Springs, Taneytown, Cave Springs, Gentry, and even portions of rural Fayetteville. This state-of-the-art school facility is just 5 years old, and the teaching staff appear equally shiny, evidenced by their aggressive adoption of the new Common Core standard. For now, only K through second grades are required by the State Department of Education to follow the new curriculum. But Karen Showalter, who teaches fourth grade, said they are way ahead of the curve. She and her colleagues last summer began to map the new Common Core learning expectations, which uses an interdisciplinary approach to learning mathematics, English language arts, literacy in history and social studies, science, and technology.
Traditionally, the teacher gives all of the knowledge to the students, and the students may not necessarily have a choice in the ways that they might would like to learn something. And so what is different, what we have discovered that is different, is that we give the students choices as to maybe what aspect of the curriculum they would like to learn more about, would like to research more about, and then they choose how they would like to show their knowledge to prove that they have actually learned this.
And for starters, they chose to research physiology, fourth graders studying physiology, specifically the digestive system.
The pancreas, the liver, you know, the large intestine, small intestine, they chose something about the digestive system that they wanted to learn and investigate more about. And then they had to decide how they were going to teach their peers about their expert knowledge about their body part. So we gave them a list of choices. They could choose to create a poster to display their information. They could choose to create a PowerPoint presentation to display their knowledge. They could write a song or poem.
Kind of like show and tell, but everyone has to take notes. Quite a few chose the poster presentation. They still hang above the whiteboard. Colorful drawings of the liver and pancreas. Cynthia Voss, principal, says Shaw Elementary faculty are experts at integrative teaching because they also use the eSTEM system adopted by the school district 2 years ago.
The eSTEM plus two model is a Springdale model that we have used, and it stands for economics, science, technology, engineering, math, and the plus two is literacy and the arts. So it really is just a way that we have used as a district to integrate the disciplines.
Fourth grade teacher Jennifer Schutnick says her students have easily taken to Common Core.
And I think that so much of the kids' perception and reaction comes as a natural response to their teacher. And as the Common Core has really been an exciting endeavor for our staff, the kids have seen that in our reactions to the expectations and just kind of embraced it as their own.
And they likely retain more of their subjects. Unlike rote learning, which may evaporate after test taking, Common Core will have teachers spending less time on memorization and procedures and more time on illustrating understanding, discussion, and analysis. Karen Showalter.
We're going to have to today put this technology into their hands. We're going to have to groom them so that they become problem solvers and critical thinkers, because otherwise they're not going to be able to compete in a global society with other countries that are already starting to work on these engineering and technology issues. And I feel that, you know, with Common Core, it is very critical. Their critical thinking skills are being emphasized more, and their problem solving. And we're teaching them to become thinkers, and we're not teaching them what to think.
Professor Mike Doherty heads the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Arkansas. He incorporated Common Core standards into his courses last year.
Well, the standards movement started in full force back in the 1990s, and every discipline would develop their own standards, both at the national level and then ultimately at the state and district level. And I would say most school districts today probably depend most heavily on the state standards that were derived from discipline-based national standards. For example, in Arkansas, we use the frameworks. The Common Core standards are an effort by the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers, and it was a national effort, but there were huge numbers of individuals involved in refining that, in testing it, in reviewing it, and giving feedback on that, and that included school teachers, administrators, members of the public. And I would say probably if you read the standards, one of the most striking differences is that they are written to the layperson, even though they're covering, in some cases, extremely complex technical information from the disciplines. They're written in such a way that the average parent could probably understand why they were important.
For example, math curriculum will be less about formulas and more about solving practical real-world problems.
I like them because they're practical, they make sense, they're applied in numerous ways. And if you look at any particular standard, you'll be able to find numerous ways that particular standard could be applied in the classroom through activity, through lessons, through examinations.
And Professor Doherty is preparing his university students to help with statewide adoption.
Well, there's a lot going on. I think that most, particularly in the elementary schools, we're seeing a lot of action, a lot of professional development, a lot of teachers interested in how they're going to apply these standards, and particularly in our program here, where we're preparing people who will be teaching next year in the schools. We're trying to get in front of this and be leaders and make sure that our candidates who leave this institution are able to go to schools and be comfortable with the standards, be conversant with them, and be able to apply them almost immediately. And maybe they might serve as a leader in those various schools where they work toward the implementation of the Common Core standards.
Common Core proponents claim the standards will provide students knowledge and skills to succeed in college and or careers. Since 2002, public schools have labored to meet another set of standards, No Child Left Behind. It requires all students to score at their grade level on state math and literacy tests by 2014, regardless of race, ethnicity, poverty level, disability, or language barrier. But because so many states are lagging in necessary benchmarks, the U.S. Department of Education is allowing states to request waivers from parts of the existing law. Arkansas will submit its waiver in early 2012.
So we absolutely support and applaud our state's opportunity to get a waiver. We hope that it comes forward because we think that will relieve some of the conflict between the old system and the new system.
Dr. Marcia Jones is Associate Superintendent for Curriculum, Instruction, Accountability, and Education for Springdale Public Schools.
Well, we are very excited about it. We think it takes our kids to a level of rigor that we think they're capable of doing.
Especially an inordinate number of English language learners in this district.
It's always a challenge with a second language learner, for it's not that they're not very, very capable of doing it. They really are capable of doing it, but it's the matter of having them have time to get the English language under control. But as we visited with national consultants, their response is just expose them to the material that will build that academic language. So we've been engaged in helping kids get their English language acquisition accelerated, and that will continue with the Common Core. The intellectual ability that's embedded in the Common Core is well within our reach. I had a mom tell me, and she is a mother of a child who has a second language, that her child in kindergarten was already learning how to read. And she said, I'm so grateful for that, even though her English wasn't as perfect. She said, I'm so grateful that my kindergarten child is being able to read now, because before Common Core, they weren't learning to read until much later. So we're finding that our second language learners are adapting to this new rigor, and we're excited to get them dual language. That's what we want, the best of English, the best of their native language as well.
And dual language speakers, along with Common Core educated Arkansans, will be better prepared to compete in the global marketplace. At least that's the theory. Next school year, Common Core rollout will continue into upper grade levels with assessments planned for 2014. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
According to the Northwest Arkansas Point-in-Time Homeless Census 2011 report, it's estimated that on any given night, approximately 2,000 people in Benton and Washington counties are homeless. A new project called Christopher's House aims to help families by giving them a place to stay while they transition to a more permanent home of their own. David Freeman is the executive pastor of First United Methodist Church of Springdale, one of the organizations working on this project.
Christopher's House is a home for transitional families, families who have no home of their own or are continually moving from temporary housing arrangement to another, one to another, and it provides a place for them to live for 12 to 18 months while they kind of get their feet underneath them and are able to establish a home, a more permanent living arrangement of their own. It is a joint project between First United Methodist Church in Springdale and Seven Hills Homeless Center, where the church is providing the house and kind of a support network or a community, and Seven Hills provides the placement of the families and then all of the case management and support and training for the families to learn the skills of maintaining and running a home of their own.
Now, how did you come to the conclusion that there was a need for this in the community and that it was one that you wanted to help fulfill?
Well, our church has wanted to address the issue of homelessness in our region for a long time. We've known that there's a problem, but we know that homelessness in Northwest Arkansas looks different than the stereotypical homelessness that you see in other parts of the country, mainly more metropolitan, larger cities. That one third of the homeless population in Northwest Arkansas are families, are family units that are trying to stay together as a unit while trying to find a better living situation. They may be living in a motel or in their car or moving from one relative's house to another, sleeping on their couch or floor or whatever. And we have been trying to figure out how to address this, and it's been something that's, we've really struggled with how to address. And we had this property right next to our church's property, a house that we have always wanted to buy as to incorporate into our church campus. And we realized that we could use this house to house families just like this and maybe make it a multi-family dwelling where they would live and could have a more permanent place or a temporarily permanent, more long-term than just a few weeks or one night at a time. And turn it into that. And then Seven Hills came to us about the same time we were identifying this piece of property, and they said, they are in desperate need of places to place people, homes or just room to place people. They said that they would provide all of the support for that if we could just provide the place. And so that got the ball rolling on this, and we decided to pursue purchasing the project. Through all of this, there was a young father and husband in our church named Chris Waller, who last year died in a car accident. And he was kind of your quintessential father and husband. He dedicated everything to his family and believed that his number one priority and role in his life was to be a father and husband. He worked very hard. He was incredibly good at what he did in his work. He was had a lot of hobbies, but all of it was a distant second to his role in his family. And what we thought was utilizing his legacy as one who kind of taught us what it meant to be a part of a family, using his legacy to make this possible. And so we got with his wife, and she jumped on board and pulled together a team of friends and family, and we've been able to open the doors this Sunday.
And on Sunday there will be an open house that begins at 8:30?
Right, at 8:30, the house will be open for people to tour and just see what it looks like. We've been remodeling it since about October when we purchased it. And then at 10:40, we will have a service of dedication and a ribbon cutting. And then, of course, after that, people will still be able to go in and see the house. And then the families, we're hoping, will move in next week.
And you will have, is there more than one family moving in?
Yes. At this point, we don't know if next week there'll be more than one family, but it's big enough to have nine people or two families. As we were thinking two families of four would be able to live there.
Now, you mentioned that Seven Hills Homeless Shelter had said that they are really in need of room. So there's a lot of people needing a place to stay. So how do you decide who gets to stay at Christopher's house?
Seven Hills will do all of the background checks and kind of discernment of who that is. They have a process of how do they qualify? What is the need? Are their kids already in that school district? We are really close to the Jones Center, so that they already connected to the Jones Center in some way. The other is that in this kind of living arrangement, while it is rent free, they do pay a program fee, which pays for the utilities of the house mostly. In fact, that's really what it all will cover, is the utilities. And so it has to be a family that does have the ability to pay those utilities. And then finally, the other piece of that would just be those who are willing to go through Seven Hills' program to learn those skills. They have a very detailed and intentional process of teaching things like financial planning and saving, and they offer job skills, and they offer training and emotional support and that kind of thing. If there are any issues of addiction, they have a part of their process that they lead through that kind of health. And so they have to be willing and a good candidate for that.
Is there anything else that we should know?
The biggest thing for us is that we are a church, and so this is a great act of faith for us. And we want this to be something that glorifies God and is a living legacy to Chris. And those two things go hand in hand to us. And so it's really exciting for his family to see what he started through his life continue on through the lives of so many others.
The open house begins at 8:30 a.m. Sunday at Christopher's house, which is located at 402 Main Street in Springdale. More information is available at fumcwired.com/causes.
Earth, sky.
Good news in the war on germs. Researchers have deciphered a new chemical code that disease-carrying bacteria use to rally themselves. They call it AX21.
They send out these signals, and it's sort of like an enemy communication that allows them to mobilize group action.
That's plant scientist Pamela Ronald of UC Davis, who led the study. She said AX21 is a protein made inside the bacterial cell, processed to generate a signal, and then secreted outside the bacterium.
when there are enough signals, that means that there's enough bacteria to actually completely change from benign organisms to being very fierce invaders, and that they will then attack, be able to coordinate attacks on their targets.
Those targets include plants, animals, and even humans that can become very susceptible to these bacterial infections.
This particular disease that we look at that infects the rice crop can cause 50% reduction in yield. And so the hope is that once, now that we understand the strategy which these bacteria can communicate, we can develop methods to really disrupt their infection process.
More at our website, EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
A jazzy holiday tradition continues tonight at the Unitarian Church in Fayetteville. The Claudia Burson Trio, actually tonight it's a quartet, will pick out a collection of Christmas and holiday tunes. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently talked with Steve Wilkes, the ensemble's drummer, about tonight's concert. Steve explained why tonight the trio is a quartet.
Usually it's Claudia on piano, me on the drums, and Drew Packard on bass. That's the trio. But tonight, Ben Harris is going to join us. And Ben is an excellent guitar player.
Yes, he is.
Have you heard Ben play?
I have.
Yes, he's phenomenal. And so Ben's a good friend of ours, and we just thought, come on and do this Christmas show with us.
You've been doing this Christmas show at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fayetteville a number of years now.
I think this is the fifth or sixth year that we've done it. And it really was like all things that become a tradition. You think, well, we'll do this once and it'll be fun and everybody will come out and have a good time. But it's really turned into quite a nice tradition for the community, for that fellowship, and kind of for us too.
When I last talked to you about this concert, it was a couple of years ago, and you surprised me by saying that Christmas music was among, if not your favorite music to play.
Oh, yeah. It's great. The Christmas standards, so Frosty the Snowman and O Come All Ye Faithful, and all those tunes translate very well into jazz recordings or the jazz style. So, yeah, I love playing that stuff. And I mean, I wouldn't want to play it every day. It'd be like eating turkey every day. But, you know, at this time of year, how can you not like, you know, swinging the jingle bells, you know?
I would imagine that one of the great things about playing Christmas music is everybody knows it.
Yeah, it's one of the great things about it and kind of one of the downfalls of it, too, in a way. I think because everyone has an idea of what the song should sound like. And, of course, jazz being jazz, it might not always sound the way you might think. But yeah, you know, so do we have a set list? We have a list. And so we've got about 20 tunes picked out. And then from that, we'll narrow it down. We plan to play about 80 to 90 minutes. I think if you go more than an hour and a half, people are going to, you know, start throwing pitchforks at you. I don't care who you are. But so we'll make sure that we keep it to that. But it'll be things that everyone knows and loves.
Because these are songs everyone knows, I mean, if you or whomever calls out Jingle Bells, mm-hmm. you don't need charts or anything, right? You can just go?
You can, but we like to have music. We like to have charts mm-hmm. because you can call it in any key. You know, so it could be in B flat or G or whatever. So it's helpful to have some. And the changes could be different, you know, and chord progressions in jazz kind of aren't necessarily traditional. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got something that's a little outside, then you need to have that written out a little bit. But you're right, though. You could just call the tune and just play it, and it would be fine.
You mentioned it's standards, but safe to say Grandma is safe. She's not going to be hit by a reindeer tonight.
She will not be hit by a reindeer.
Thank goodness.
No one's going to see Grandma. Anybody sleeping with Santa or whatever the heck you do with
kissing.
Santa.
Kissing.
Well, yes. It's an adult show.
I don't know which
Sorry.
Christmas songs you heard. But
whatever Santa does.
Right.
So, no, there won't be
Schlock.
Schlock. There won't be any of that. There's actually some really pretty stuff. We've got one of the songs that I'm actually quite excited about playing, which we've never played before, is from the Vince Guaraldi's Charlie Brown compilation. And there's a lovely little waltz called Skating.
That's one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Christmas songs.
It's one of mine, too. And I just threw it at Claudia the other day and said, what do you think about playing this? And we just, I don't know, we just haven't had the music or it just hasn't come around. And she said, yeah. And so she went and she found the music. And she and Ben are actually rehearsing that song today before we do the show tonight.
It's at the Unitarian Universalist Church.
Mm-hmm.
Good acoustics there?
Very good acoustics. This is a great place to hear a concert, to hear any kind of music. I don't know what they did right in that space, but it has great acoustics. I love playing in there. And, you know, most church sanctuaries are kind of acoustically tuned. So, yeah, it's really good. It's an intimate setting. About 135 or 40 people can fit in there.
Open to all, not
open
just Unitarians.
To all. Oh, no. Mm-mm. And really, that's one of the nice things about this concert is we're not – the point of it is not to have you come and become a Unitarian. The point of it is to kick off your holiday season. And if you like jazz and you want to hear some holiday music without anything attached to it, this is a good place to do so. I don't know of any other concert like this that's going on at the Walton Arts Center anywhere else. There's great concerts going on, don't get me wrong. But to hear small group jazz dedicated to the music of the season in a concert setting, so there aren't plates rattling around and bartenders throwing things around. It's a place to come in here, and the whole family can come, and there will be a wine and dessert, I think, reception afterward.
And this raises money for?
It's for the church, and they take the money that they raise and they turn it back to the community. They do some wonderful projects. One that my wife Gretchen is heavily involved with is feeding the homeless thing that they're collaborating with some other churches around town. And so those kinds of projects, you know, helping the community sustain itself. So it's really a worthwhile cause. It's a great way to spend a Friday evening, and I hope to see all of you out there tonight.
Steve Wilkes will be at the drums tonight when the Claudia Bursin Quartet plays a jazz Christmas concert at the Unitarian Church on Cleveland Street in Fayetteville. Doors open at 7. The music begins at 7:30. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this week.
I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight. On this week's program, we'll hear 2 hours of great music, and the first hour will be uninterrupted music. You'll hear Herbie Hancock and Charlie Hayden, John Scofield, Brad Meldow, and much more. The second hour, music from Rahsaan Roland Kirk, McCoy Tyner, Stefan Harris. Tune in Friday night at 10 o'clock for Shades of Jazz.
It's Friday, December 16th, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So on Tuesday evening, this guy was Jimmy the Autopsy Gremlin's future father-in-law on NCIS.
Wait, what?
This person.
Okay. Continue.
If you watch NCIS, you get it.
Okay.
You know that? Okay, NCIS folks, you know that guy that was Jimmy's future father-in-law? Tonight, that guy, who is Larry Miller, is on stage at the Walton Arts Center.
Okay, wow.
Well, I think...
Is that bizarre?
Yes, but I don't understand the NCIS reference, so sorry. I remember him from, like, 10 Things I Hate About You. He was, like, the dad.
Oh, yeah, and Princess Diaries and Waiting for Guffman and Pretty Woman. But he was just on NCIS, like a major guest.
Sorry. Okay. I know.
I'm sorry you don't get it. But trust me, the people that I'm talking to get it.
I understand.
So he's here.
Okay.
And Ashley Batchelor, one of our WhatsApp reporters, interviewed him and says he is the nicest guy ever. Nothing like that character on NCIS.
Well, good.
He said he fell in love with comedy listening to people like Bill Cosby and Bob Newhart and Robert Klein and started doing the typical stand-ups at the family dinner table, doing their routines, and then started writing comedy that he says has to do with experiences that are common to everyone. So his show tonight is about how life is a cocktail.
Oh.
He says one of his favorite lines from it is about marriage, children, and drinking, and how one of them always leads to the other two.
Okay.
Think about that.
I will think about that.
He's also going to be playing piano. He was a music major in school and made his living as a drummer and piano player for a couple of years.
Hmm.
And he'll do some original songs and some parodies. And he says he'll be talking about the period between Thanksgiving and the New Year and how even the crabbiest people get a little introspective. Quote, I think probably even assassins think, how can I be a better murderer?
Oh.
I don't care who you are. That's funny.
That is funny.
Oops, wrong comedian. Yeah. 8 o'clock today, Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Tickets start at $16.
Oh, maybe I should do this.
I think so. That's tonight.
Okay.
Tomorrow night, you've got to make a choice between the ridiculous and the sublime.
All right.
Fun Bags will be on stage at the
UARC
Bowl.
Right. Is that the ridiculous?
Yes.
I hope so.
I hope so. Or the Arkansas Philharmonic is going to be so unhappy with me. 8 o'clock, so it's a later start time, but doors at 7:15.
Okay.
And the Arkansas Philharmonic is on stage at the Arendt Arts Center for a night of holiday cheer. The Philharmonic has everybody on stage with them. The Ozark Bronze Handbell Ensemble, the Bella Vista Men's and Women's Choruses. They're doing songs like White Christmas and Drummer Boy and Carol of the Bells, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mannheim Steamroller version of Silent Night.
Okay. I've always been interested in seeing handbells. I've never really actually seen them, except like been made fun of on TV or something. But I'd like to see somebody who actually knows how to use them.
I have never. They say this is a professional level handbell choir. I've never seen them live either. So Amanda and Larry and I are going.
There you go.
Because it'll be fun. 7:30 Saturday at the Arendt Arts Center. It's $5 for students and $20 for adults. Or there's one more choice.
One more choice.
Classic. Or something completely different.
Okay, give me classic first.
Moscow Classical Ballet.
Ah.
On stage at the Walton Arts Center at 8 on Saturday and 2 and 7 on Sunday. And guess what they're doing this time of year?
Nutcracker.
Good guess. Because that's what you do. Local kids.
Oh.
Doing the party scene. Tickets start at $38. Or there's something called the First Ornaments of Christmas.
Okay.
It's a brand new nativity rock opera.
I'm sorry, what?
Four local musicians, Bryce Napier, Trevor Bates, Cameron Hager, and Toby Wills, have written a rock opera.
Okay.
Complete with animation. So there's visuals about Christmas.
Interesting. All right.
They call it the First Ornaments of Christmas to explain the meaning behind the angel, the star, and the shepherds. That those are the first ornaments.
Mm. Oh, I see.
And that would be 7:30 tonight at Vintage Fellowship in Fayetteville. 8:30 Monday at George's. That's $5.
Okay.
And 7 o'clock Wednesday at the Central Student Center at Fellowship Bible Church in Rogers.
So I have multiple options and times to catch this.
And you have to remember Theater Squared's It's a Wonderful Life,
of course.
Too. Which, by the way, showtimes are wrong in today's What's Up because it's put together on Wednesday. It prints on Thursday morning.
Mm-hmm. And this came out Thursday.
They say, due to high ticket demand for It's a Wonderful Life, they've added two performances for the upcoming week, and they've canceled the Saturday matinee.
Oh, okay.
Family emergency. The ones they've added are 7 o'clock on Tuesday, and that's a 65th anniversary performance celebrating the 65th anniversary of It's a Wonderful Life, and there will be a champagne toast at intermission.
Oh, fine.
Then there's a show Wednesday at 2 o'clock. That's a family matinee. And a show Friday the 23rd at 2 o'clock, a family matinee. And you can find out all about that at 443-5600.
Excellent. Thank you, Becca.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this week. We've got some Etta James, Peter Karp and Sue Foley, Bobby Rush, Chris Cameron, Marquise Knox, and a few others. And the Generic Blue Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
What do a businessman, a chemist, an accountant, and a photojournalist have in common? Give up? They all make liquor in one form or another inside the state of Arkansas. Our tour of locally made liquor begins on the south side of Fayetteville, at the intersection of 15th Street and South School, where former photojournalist J.T. Wambler has set up shop as Tanglewood Branch Brewing Company.
I've been making beer for a few years. I haven't thought about much else for the last couple of years. I was working for the newspaper, and things weren't looking that great in the newspaper business, so I started seeing what was recession-proof, and beer is pretty recession-proof.
Not only brewing for personal consumption, Wampler also had a brief stint at the Hog House in Fayetteville, working with a world-class brewer, learning how to produce beer on a much larger scale. A former gas station, the building has been completely gutted, except for the walk-in cooler, and retrofitted to house a 7-barrel brewing system. When brewing begins early next year, Wampler says he will produce about 200 gallons each year. In the meantime, he has a selection of good craft beer on tap.
I try to keep the taps changing as much as I can with what I'm able to buy. And so people know that when they come here, there's probably going to be something different on tap.
Wampler is currently awaiting federal consent to brew his own beer, a lengthy process that also involves approval of the name and logo of the beer. If the feds don't like the name, they can deny the permit.
So to avoid that, you link your name to a local geological or geographical entity, a street or a river or a mountain, something like that. They love those names. They, from what I understand, rubber stamp those kinds of names because they don't have to think about them. The Tanglewood Branch is a little creek that actually begins in the Walmart Center parking lot. That little stone grotto is the headwaters of the Tanglewood Branch. And it flows from there down underneath MLK, and then it crosses under school and joins up with another creek over at Walker Park. So it's a tiny little neighborhood creek, and we're a tiny little neighborhood pub.
Fitting, Tanglewood Branch's logo is a gnarly tree.
Hey, guys.
Hey, sir, can we get some lunch? Or?
Yeah, lunch, I'll take care of it.
Tanglewood Branch also offers food in the way of panini sandwiches and soups and daily specials. Though Wampler would be satisfied remaining a little corner pub, he says both space upstairs and next door is available if expansion is needed when House Brews hit taps next March. Our tour of locally made liquor takes us northeast of Fayetteville to a vineyard and winery just east of Eureka Springs. What started out as an operation for personal use has grown to production of 5,000 gallons, or 2,000 cases of wine each year. Former chemist Doug Hausler and his wife, Edvie J. Dennison, moved to the area in the early 2000s, planting grapes at that time. Growing grape, Hausler says, is just one of those things.
You can put a plant in the ground. It'll grow probably well enough as long as you water it. But there's a whole lot of agriculture activities that you have to do then. And it is a full-time job to do about 8 to 10 acres of grape.
When their vineyard was ready for production in 2006, Keels Creek Winery opened. Similar to the maturing of a grapevine, so is the production of wine. Beginning with de-stemming and crushing, the juice is then tanked for a few weeks, while the sugars turn to alcohol.
It would take another 4 to 6 months before that wine is clarified enough. If it's a white, we may bottle it at that point, and it would be a drinkable wine. Well, we may let it go a little longer, but it would be the beginning of that. For most of our reds, we would put them into barrels from anywhere from 1 to 3 to 4 years.
After what Hausler calls the Easter Massacre of 2007, when extremely cold weather killed off their Merlot and Pinot Noir grapes, they are now sticking to American and French hybrid varieties. They are more suitable to the winter elements. These hybrid grapes are names that are largely unrecognizable to this amateur wine enthusiast. Names like Chamberson, a big bold red, and Vivant, a vivacious white.
So we do have some varieties that aren't necessarily the top 10 of California, but then as we tell people in our taste room, they're not in California.
While Keels Creek does not grow all of these varieties, they are all grown within a 30-mile radius of the winery. Hausler says that buying locally is a unique feature of Keels Creek. Another unique feature is the art gallery that is also housed in the Spanish-style building. Visitors may enjoy the works of local artists while they enjoy their wine.
Our artists are from Arkansas and Oklahoma, and we try to fit the theme of the winery and the art together. So much so that a lot of the artwork, the labels that we have on our wines are chosen from art pieces that we have in either the winery or local artists or something related to artwork.
Keels Creek wines are available at the winery, which is open daily December through March and throughout the summer when the owners are in town. With 12 wines available in the tasting room, they have something for everyone. We move southeast to Little Rock, where Rocktown Distillery operates. It is the first distillery in Arkansas since Prohibition. The first legal distillery, that is. Phil Branded can tell that his day job was in danger when Verizon took over Alltel. He began looking into other options and came across a trend in craft distilling that was occurring across the country.
Read more about it and asked the question of myself, why wasn't there a distillery in Arkansas? And I decided to pursue that idea, and once I got it got a hold of me, it wouldn't let me go, and I kept working on it and was able to make it happen, you know?
This is the second time the word craft has been heard on our tour. Brandon says that it is a term that started with the craft beer movement, when people realized that they could make something other than Miller or Coors. For him, it means small and local.
You use, locally grown or natural ingredients to create a spirit that's basically made by hand. We don't use any automation. We don't have any big computer systems spitting out millions of gallons of spirit. We do it in small batches and make it by hand, similar to what a lot of microbreweries do with their small systems.
Rocktown began making vodka and gin, marketed with the name Brandon's, in September of 2010. An unaged whiskey called Arkansas Lightning followed shortly thereafter.
Arkansas Lightning just kind of harkens back to the idea that back in the day, there were moonshiners that were running corn liquor or lightning or moonshine or hooch or whatever you want to call it around the state. And so I decided to call mine Arkansas Lightning.
Arkansas Lightning is clear in color, as it hasn't been aged in a barrel like other whiskeys. Brandon says it can be consumed on the rocks or mixed with sweet tea or lemonade due to the light color and slight sweetness. Lightning, as well as Brandon's gin, vodka, and whiskey, can be purchased at liquor stores throughout Arkansas and in six other states, an endeavor that Brandon credits in part to various awards and ratings his liquor has received. Brandon's gin received a double gold rating in the San Francisco World Spirits Competition.
There are multi-million-dollar brands that enter this that don't even, get a bronze, much less a double gold. And here we are, a little distillery from Little Rock, Arkansas, with a guy that used to work in telecom, now, making a gin that's competing with the very best there is to offer, It's kind of crazy in that competition. It's not just for little guys like me, the big multi-million dollar brands are in there. We actually got a higher rating than Tanqueray, than Beefeater, and Hendrix.
Rocktown Distillery is open on Saturdays for tours and tastings, as well as for private parties. With only 3 employees, they ask people to come in and help with the bottling. Brandon calls these bottling parties.
Well, one of the things about all our bottles is we actually sign and number each bottle by hand. And so the volunteers that come in to help actually get to sign bottles as well. And so it's kind of cool that everybody gets to sign bottles, and there's no telling where they might end up.
Our tour began in Fayetteville, and so will it end. An accountant by day, on Saturday nights, Amber Hurlbut is a bartender at Infusions on Dixon Street. Hurlbut says the name of the bar has a dual meaning. Formerly Zulu's, Infusions has the same owner and staff. They wanted to infuse the old with something new. That something new is, in part, house-made infused liquors. Yet another trend sweeping the bars and restaurants across the nation. For Hurlbut, she enjoys the creativity involved in the process.
It was different from what everybody else was doing, and it would give us a name, and, you know, it would be also creative and fun for us as bartenders, too, to do it.
Filtering the liquors removes some of the alcohol bite from the liquor, readying it for infusion.
If I use fruit or vegetables, a lot of times I cut, I'll chop them up really fine and stick them in these jars that we have. The amount of time that it takes to infuse the liquor depends on what it is that I'm working with. Something like tea, it infuses very quickly because that's the nature of tea. Something that is like cinnamon, that takes a little bit more time for the liquor to penetrate it into the flavor to come out.
Hurlbut tries to have a variety of liquors and flavors, using all types of booze. A pineapple and blackberry flavored tequila has been a popular one, used in a basic margarita. Hurlbut says it's best to keep drinks simple due to the dramatic flavors of the liquors. Another popular drink at the moment is a Bloody Mary, using a sugar beet vodka.
People have, said this is like one of the best or the best Bloody Mary that they've ever had. It kind of gives it a little bit of a pickly, a little bit of a pickly kind of flavor to it.
Prices for drinks made with infused liquors are comparable to typical prices. Though Thursday through Saturday, Infusions offers a special on their infused drinks. On those nights, they are just $3. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 16th of December, 2011. It's the birthday of Jane Austen, born 1775 in Hampshire, England, seventh of eight children. Father was a clergyman. He encouraged her aspirations when it became apparent that probably she would not marry. He saw to it she had a writing desk, plenty of ink and paper. Her father died suddenly, and the family needed money when Sense and Sensibility came out in 1811. Jane Austen widely read in her lifetime, but she published all her books simply as a lady rather than using her own name. Her health began to decline. 5 years later, she died at 41, possibly of Addison's disease or lymphoma, or someone recently suggested arsenic poisoning. Virginia Woolf called her the most perfect artist among women. And Mark Twain said, "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig her up and beat her over the skull with her own shin bone." 200 years ago today, 1811, two enormous earthquakes struck the Louisiana Territory near the borders of Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Tennessee. The most severe quakes ever to hit the eastern United States, about 8.0 on the Richter scale. Eyewitnesses said that the Mississippi River appeared to reverse course. The soil liquefied, plumes of sulfurous gas shot up from the ground. The midnight quakes rang church bells in Boston, toppled chimneys in Maine. And some seismologists believe that the region is overdue for another big quake in a zone where there are 15 nuclear power plants. It's the birthday of Noel Coward, 1899, near London, author of more than 50 plays and two volumes of memoirs, Present Indicative and Future Indefinite. He began a third memoir, Past Conditional, unfinished when he died in 1973. One of his most successful plays, Blithe Spirit, written 1941, comedy about an author haunted by the ghost of his dead first wife. And it's the birthday of the science fiction author Arthur Clarke, born Minehead, Somerset, England, 1917, best known for 2001,
A Space Odyssey. He also was an inventor. He developed an early warning radar system during World War II. On his 90th birthday, a few months before he died, Arthur Clarke said, "I have great faith in optimism as a guiding principle, if only because it offers us the opportunity of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. I hope we've learned something from the most barbaric century in history, the 20th. I would like to see us overcome our tribal divisions and begin to think and act as if we were one family." Here's a poem for today by Jason Schindler, The Good Son. If God had come to me and said, "If you are willing to forget yourself, you will find the cure for heart attacks and compose the greatest symphonies," I wouldn't have been sure of my answer, because there wouldn't have been enough attention to my suffering. And that's unforgivable. But I keep on forgiving myself with God's love. And it's strange I should say this, because my mother died of a heart attack after months in a hospital room full of a silence that lodged itself like a stone in her throat. And she thought I was wonderful and would do anything for her. The Good Son by Jason Schindler, from his collection Stupid Hope, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, partners with the National Endowment for the Arts in Poetry Out Loud, a national poetry recitation contest for high school students. More information at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
From the debate over raising the federal debt limit to extending last year's payroll tax cut, KUAF has kept you informed on the most important events of 2011. The news won't let up in 2012. Please help us bring that news to you. Make a year-end tax-deductible gift at KUAF.com. That's KUAF.com, and you can click on Contribute Now, and thanks.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, serving the communities of Siloam Springs, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Little Arkansas.
Where is that?
It is east of Alpena.
Okay.
And it's Arkansas with a W,
well,
not
fancy.
An S.
Yes. Something a little different.
Yes.
I like it. I like it. And before we go, we got a couple events to look forward to tomorrow. An open Irish session jam is set for the third Saturday of every month at the Perk on Weddington in Fayetteville. The next one is tomorrow from 2 to 4. This is an ongoing open jam session for beginners as well as advanced players. Come share a tune, come dance, or just listen. For more information, you can contact Carol at Carol Witter, that's W-I-D-D-E-R, at yahoo.com.
And nature photographer Tim Ernst will be at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History tomorrow at 2 p.m. He will present Arkansas Portfolio 3, a slideshow featuring his newest photos of the Arkansas landscape. The Shiloh Museum is located at the corner of Johnson and Main in downtown Springdale. For more information, 750-8165.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
You have big plans for the weekend?
Not really.
Not really?
No.
I don't either, but I think I need to do some Christmas shopping. Not quite done yet.
I'm not doing a lot this year, so.
Maybe that's the best.
I'm almost finished, really.
Okay, well, I still have some to work. Maybe that's the best strategy. Don't need to buy that much. Then you don't have to worry about it.
Well, good luck.
All right, well, thank you. And thanks for hosting today. And Ithi Agnihotri-Madolker and Kyle Kelms will be back on Sunday.
Yes.
Have a good weekend.
Happy Friday.